So I want to introduce now one of my good friends from many programs, which shall remain anonymous unless he admits to them, Steve M.
Hi, I'm Steve, and still an adult child of adult children of alcoholics. And just had this device clipped to me to be recorded. So does that mean that Angie wasn't recorded? Oh, that's a bummer. Can you see why I married this woman? I mean, I still have to pinch myself sometimes. You know, when I saw this topic, you know, of course, I always like to make sure I understand, you know, what's being asked of me, and so that I can respond well. And so I looked up the words, you know, restored, insanity, and relationship. So restored, brought back into a former or original state. Sanity, the quality or state of being able to anticipate and appraise the effects of one's actions. Relationship, connection or kinship. So restored to sanity in relationship is being able to connect and be aware of the effect of one's actions. And I have to tell you, it wasn't until the ripe age of 31 years old in 1988 when I began my recovery that I even began to start to see how I was completely incapable of any of this. And, you know, I want to just share a little bit about kind of the crack in the foundation that really took me right out of position from being able to have anything resembling a sane relationship with anyone or anything, really, other than my dog Heidi when I was a kid. That dog helped me get through my teen years. I mean, I don't know, you know, I'd come home from school and she'd be waiting. But I mean, my story begins actually in the womb. I started practicing codependency when my mom was pregnant with me because I had an older brother who was diagnosed with Wilms' tumor. He was, you know, 2 years old, and my mom told me later that she was praying that I wouldn't be born until he came home from the hospital. And I didn't come until after he came home from the hospital. So I was very obedient, even, you know, prenatally. And unfortunately, when I was about 6 months old, he was in the hospital again, only this time dying. And I was sent from my parents to be with grandparents. So I never really completed that bonding, you know, with either of my parents. I never felt a really connection with either of my parents. And I remember sitting in church, and we had that there was a stained glass window in the church that we attended, and it had this picture of Jesus holding a lamb, and then beneath it, it had my brother's name and his birth date and his date of death. And I just could never really wrap my head around, you know, people saying about, you know, God calling him home and that kind of thing. But all I knew was that when we went home, my parents never recovered from that, you know, and it's typical, you know, when two people lose the child, a lot of times in the marriage never survives that, and my parents didn't survive that. And so that kind of tainted my perception of a loving higher power, and then the kind of the icing on the cake was really the only person in my family that I felt safe around was my maternal grandfather, and I used to spend a lot of time at his house and watching ball games and helping him. I remember he gave me a little block of wood to pound on when I was a kid when he was working on the car, and I felt like I was helping him. And he died suddenly when I was 12 years old. He died while painting the preacher's house. And so I did a lot of shaking my fist at God. And so now here I don't have a relationship with my mother or my father or God. And I go off out into the world now, and is it any wonder I'm completely incapable of forming friendships. I'm completely incapable, forget about relationships with the opposite sex. I'm incapable of staying in a workplace for any length of time because I have personalities before principles with coworkers and especially bosses, because I have real a lot of trouble with authority. So that kind of, you know, paves the foundation of where I started. And I love this, you know, there's a lot of talk in literature about the promises. Well, someone pointed out to me that if you ever wondered what the promises were of our spiritual malady, it's on page 52 in the big book, and it says, we were having trouble with personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. We were prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy. We couldn't seem to be of real help to other people. That describes it exactly. I don't know if anyone else here identifies, but that's what it was like. I was very dutifully trying to live according to these five rules of, quote, civilized society. I heard a speaker share this. One, you cannot have anything wrong with you. Two, if you do have anything wrong with you, get over it fast. Three, if you can't get over it fast, pretend that you did. Four, if you can't pretend, then drop out. And five, if you won't drop out, at least have the decency to look ashamed when you're around the rest of us. So yeah, that was, so it was a long journey back to GOD. My first GOD was the Gift of Desperation. And that occurred for me on November 30th. Of 1988, and I just realized I forgot to start the timer. Oops. So I'm sitting there at this point where I can't imagine my life going on anymore. I can't imagine my life continuing to live it the way I was, and I can't figure out a way to end my life. In between that rock and that hard place, and I finally surrendered, and that's when I started, you know, going to 12-step meetings. Now, I started off in a different 12-step meeting, but I had trouble with that because I didn't feel they were, you know, really. They were a little bit too harsh and unsympathetic to my unique sensitivities. So I began, I found ACA in 1990, and it was this wonderful meeting on the sand in Seal Beach, and that became my home group. And that really began a turning point in my life, because it was there that I felt safe to be able to begin to unwrap the bandage. You know, I could not see because the bandage was so, I was so wrapped up in the bandage of my wound. And it was there that I could begin to, you know, take off the armor and open my heart and begin to care about others and let others care about me. And we developed what we later called the friendship circle. One of the guys had been going to a group therapy, and he was paying his therapist $25 a week. And one day he had an epiphany. He says, you know what, instead of paying the therapist $25, I think I'm just going to buy a bunch of food and invite all these friends of mine, these new friends of mine over, and we'll have a little, you know, gathering. And that began, and we developed into this community of 10, 12, 15 people that lasted for a while. And it was so healing for me to be able to experience that. And what happened was I really started to kind of have a second adolescence. You know, I never was able to date in high school. I kind of took a hostage or was taken hostage. There was no such thing for me as investigate, evaluate, and then decide. You know, it was like seize the opportunity now before, you know, might be the last one, you know. And but that night I was there, you know, and I had that sense of impending doom. And I believe I had a sense of impending doom because doom was impending. And I'm just so grateful because I had a friend who kind of paved the way and was an example, he started going to 12-step program, and I saw the transformation happening in him. So he carried the message of hope to me. The second GOD became the group, the fellowship. Somebody said, you know, I really have a hard time with this whole higher power thing, and even, you know, don't even use the three-letter word GOD. And they said, well, think about it this way. You know, think about yourself home alone trying to recover by yourself. How much power is in that? Now, think of yourself in a group of people that have a common problem and a common desire to solve that problem and a common solution. How much power is in that? Is the group a power greater than you by yourself? And I was like, yeah. So that was the beginning. And I started to really experience this power, like the power of unity, of the singleness of purpose, the power of shared experience, the power of wisdom, the power of love and caring. And that was visceral to me. And someone said, we don't even have to understand this power in order to plug into it and have access to it. And so that was a big turning point. And then finally, the third GOD was the good orderly direction in the 12 steps. I've heard it described as a design for living. And prior to that, I didn't have a design for living. I lived on instincts gone awry. I lived from self-centered fear. I lived from justified resentments. And I lived from this any given moment. You were a terrified infant running the show, or a rageful adolescent, you know. And the recovery process for me had been about, you know, starting to be able to identify and acknowledge these, like, broken off parts and wounded parts of myself, and be able to, you know, embrace them and allow them expression in a healthy way around safe people. And ACA provided that. And what eventually started to happen was as I was experiencing recovery, you know, they said, you know, we can't keep it unless we give it away. And, you know, we can't give it away unless we have it, you know. And so I remember I had a sponsor. I really did not like the idea of becoming a sponsor. You know, I thought it was going to be way too much work, way too much commitment, way too much risk, you know. And I had this guy that I finally was able to trust another man to begin to teach me these spiritual principles and how to apply them in my life. And he had a bunch of guys that he was sponsoring. And I discovered one day that all the other guys that he was sponsoring were also sponsoring guys. I was the only one that wasn't. One day I went to him, I said, John, I think I'm becoming willing to become a sponsor. What do I do? He goes, well, all you got to do is become the kind of man where other men want what you have. I'm like, oh, what an order. But that day did come when a man asked me to sponsor. In fact, it's really funny. You know, my road since 1988, it hasn't been all strawberries and orgasms. You know, there have been times where it's been real deep depression. I went through one at like 6 years sober and clean and recovery, and I went through one in about 17 years. But this was about 15 years ago now. I was in a Tuesday noon meeting sharing how I was feeling suicidal, you know, and I was off of work on a leave of absence, and I was really messed up. And this guy comes up to me after the meeting and asks me to sponsor him. He says, I totally relate to where you're at, you know, and you're continuing to do this thing, and I want to know how you're doing it, you know, and not acting on those thoughts. And I worked with him for years, and what a privilege it's been, you know. And the really cool thing now, you know, I meet with a guy, I've been meeting with him every Thursday morning from 7 to 8, and now we talk, instead of talking about him, we're talking about guys that he's sponsoring, you know. And to see this thing passed on, it's just such a beautiful thing. You know, it talks about in the book about, you know, seeing a fellowship grow up about you. You know, you will not want to miss that. And that's been my experience. So all of this is to really, in preparation to get me in position to be able to now, you know, graduate to the PhD program of relationships. You know, and as Angie had mentioned, you know, I had been engaged to this woman for 3 days. And This was a woman who I was sitting in a meeting one time and next to my sponsor, and she walked in the room and my sponsor says, "Your drug just walked into the room." And that's really was the truth. And in a moment of passion, I proposed to her. And after later that night, after we had parted, I went into this full-on panic attack, realizing I had made that decision totally on self-will. And what I had discovered was my life had been going really well by not trying to manage it myself, and by having what I call a MAC, M-A-C, a mistake avoidance committee. You know, people in my life that I respect, that I trust their perception, and I'm willing to run things by them before acting impulsively, you know. And so I had to go back to her and say, you know, I really need more time, you know. And we were still in the investigate and evaluate, you know, and it turned out that it wasn't supposed to be. And so all this leads up to, I was on a retreat up in Big Sur, and I encountered this woman who we started to talk, and she asked me, she says, "Are you looking for a life partner?" And I was kind of startled, deer in the headlights, for, I mean, I just met her, right? And she goes, "I don't mean like necessarily with me, but I'm wanting to begin conversations with people that they know that's what they want." And I was really taken aback, but I realized I really want to give this woman an honest answer. And I pondered, I said, "Let me talk to you tomorrow about that." So the truth was that I, for the first time, I could really acknowledge to myself that I did want that. You know, before I was too afraid to acknowledge that I wanted something that I felt was out of reach. You know, it would be too painful to acknowledge that I really wanted something, but that in my heart of hearts, I didn't believe it was ever going to be possible. You know, I remember being on a drive up north with my sponsor on a Thanksgiving weekend, and we were having this conversation, and I says, "You know, John, I think I might like end up being alone the rest of my life." He goes, "Well, some of us are, you know, and that's okay. So it enables us to be more available in service and volunteer and in our community and with our families. And, you know, we're not all meant to be in relationship." And I really felt like I had a surrender and acceptance at that point. But now fast forward, and I have this acknowledgement that I really want a life partner. And I realize, you know, this is this amazing woman right in my own backyard. We met at our Sunday morning meeting, it's probably almost 20 years ago now. And I remember whenever I saw her, you know, walk in the room, I would kind of feel a little flutter of like, "Oh, Angie's here." And I would always look forward to hearing her share and just really be touched by her wisdom and her humor. And but my thought was, I mean, I was like, here's this beautiful, successful, intelligent, funny woman. What would she want to do with me, you know, have to do with me? That's where my self-esteem still was 20 years ago. I had a lot of growing still to do. And so I kind of, you know, admired her from afar for a while. And then as fate would have it, our coffee circle, we started being a part of the same coffee circle after the meeting. And there'd be about 10 or 15 of us going to coffee after the meeting. And after some time, you know, it turns out other people would be leaving. We'd be the last ones there. And then we would do our food shopping in Trader Joe's. And I remember running into her at Trader Joe's and thinking to myself, "Oh, does this mean I get another goodbye hug?" And so our relationship, stage one was characterized by friendship and longing. And then stage two was when we started to acknowledge that there was an attraction, mutual attraction. And what was going on was, you know, I was actually working another inventory in yet another 12-step program with a sponsor, and I had committed to that sponsor because I had experienced so much pain in relationship area that I committed I would not get involved until I'd completed my fifth step. And I, you know, took that commitment seriously. So I called Angie up that day in December to say I wasn't available because I wanted to clear the air. I was like, I wanted to acknowledge that, you know, we've been doing this dance and we've been doing this flirting thing, and I don't want to give you the wrong impression that I'm available when I'm really not right now, you know. And, you know, as I look back on this whole thing and how it all worked out that we ended up, we came together, I think, in the only way that it would have worked and that would have given us any chance of having a long-term go at this thing. Because my old history was, you know, the clothes would come off before my heart could have a chance to really open. And, you know, one of the things my sponsor says, he says, you have to be in a relationship long enough to let the love grow big enough to absorb the lust. And that was a big, big awakening. And so I was really certain that I had such a great deal of admiration and respect for this woman. And the key was that I trusted her. You know, as being friends, we would confide in each other about our what was going on, you know. And she was curious about this three-day engagement. I was curious about this guy that she was involved with in Hawaii, this long distance. And with that curiosity deepened, but when I started heard her speak about how she was handling situations in her life, difficult things with her daughter in the workplace, I could see this is a woman with integrity. This is someone who I could really trust. And that just deepened the attraction and deepened my sense of hope that this could work, because trust was such a big thing for me that I could not take that next step unless that was there. So, I'm going to wrap it up here so we can do some questions. So, a couple of things about the relationship. You know, one question was, you know, I see building a relationship is like building a container, you know, and can this container be big enough and strong enough to hold the fullness of the two people, our full authenticity, all the joy we bring, all the grief we bring, the anger we bring, the baggage we bring, the yearnings we bring, our heart's desires, all of that, our defects of character. Can the container we're building this relationship be strong enough and big enough to hold all that? And the other thing was, I had learned about the four R's of relationship, and this was really useful information for me, and it came at a perfect time. The four R's of relationship, first R is romance. You know, this is where everything's all great, you know, goo-goo eyes, you know, we're both putting our best foot forward, no storm clouds on the horizon. The second R is reality. And that's when we start, you know, little warts are starting to show through, and maybe a little bit of hesitation, tentativeness now. And the third R is rethinking. This isn't all just a bed of roses. I didn't notice that about. Can I live with this? Can I do better? You know, that rethinking. And it was really refreshing to hear, you know, that is a can be a normal part of the relationship process. But the fourth R is recommitment. And that was, you know, we've gone through that stage, you know, early on, and then, you know, in different points in our marriage, more so for me, because I don't quite have the emotional stability. I really can have some pretty highs and lows, and as she had said, you know, needing solitude. And there was a point where I was like wondering, I just really started to fall apart. Work life was really stressful, and adjusting, we had just moved in together about a year or two before that, and adjusting to living with someone again after living alone for so many years. So, but the beautiful thing is, with this couples community, I felt like we really had the support, and we are so grateful for that community, that it was wonderful to recognize as we stayed and worked through our stuff and was part of this community, and some of the older couples would move or die, and next thing you know, we're like, wow, we're like one of the senior couples here now, and welcoming, and we host a couples meeting, you know, and so that's what culminated us, you know, doing that book. And so the last thing I wanted to share was about, we have a little 10-step meeting that we do together. And I call this the Four Gateways to Intimacy. And we do a check-in on a weekly basis, and we've also incorporated meditating together, and we do a check-in round checking in on what we're feeling here and now and what our personal highs and lows have been for this past week. Because sometimes now in our daily life, we get so caught up and busy, you know, it's good to have that check-in. The second round is accountability. Am I in integrity with my declared intentions with myself and others? What needs to happen to be back in integrity? You know, one brief story was I had made an agreement to help Angie prepare dinner. We were having guests. She didn't even want to have the guests to begin with. She's really unusual. She loves to entertain. But we had a busy schedule going on. But I really wanted to make this happen. So I said, I'll help you with dinner. Well, it came time to get dinner going, and I was out in the garden. And, you know, the old, oh, one more thing. Oh, I want to just finish this up. Well, by the time I got cleaned up and came to the kitchen to report for duty, she was pretty much done, and little did I know, she was pretty much done. I mean, she was pissed. And she later tells the story that she was thinking, well, I know the solution to this. I'm just not going to trust him again, you know. And what my approach was, I said, you know, I want to acknowledge that we had an agreement I was going to help you, and I broke that agreement, and I'm out of integrity. And in order to get back in integrity, I want to perform a simple act of service. And for the next week, from Saturday to Sunday, I will do every dish in the sink. And she accepted that, and that was a big deal. And so nothing is more important to me now than not only just being able to have people in my life that I can trust, but to be the kind of person where other people can trust me and trust my word. The third round of this Four Gateways of Intimacy is manifestation. What am I intending for this coming week? What are my challenges and personal stretches for the coming week? And what are five things I can do for you to support you this week? And finally, the fourth is the gratitude round, acknowledgement of blessings and gratitude for this encounter, for this week, for our life together. And that's been working really well for us. And it's just been such a pleasure to be here and share with you guys. And now I'd like to open it up for any questions you might have. In the back there.
Hi there. Thank you so much. I found she's very touching, and could you kindly answer, did you choose to work multiple 12-step programs, and share which ones they were?
Well, sure.
You want to repeat the question?
Yeah, she wants to know if I worked multiple 12-step programs and which ones they were. My first meeting was Alcoholics Anonymous, and I attended that for a while, and then I found ACA and attended ACA for a while, and then I decided to do both for a while, and then I realized that I was killing myself with cigarettes, and I couldn't stop that on my own, so I attended Nicotine Anonymous, and then I realized that I had trouble in the relationship area, and that was when I started going to Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous, and that was the inventory I was working when we started to get together. And then because I couldn't stand to be in the room with my mother, I realized it might be helpful for me to go to Al-Anon, because my main issue with her was that she was an untreated Al-Anon, the way she handled my brother. And I realized I was so upset with her being an untreated Al-Anon because I was one. So I started going to Al-Anon, and now I call her every Wednesday, and we talk for, you know, sometimes an hour, and I go visit her twice a year, and I love my mom today, you know, and that's been restored to sanity, that relationship. And my final, I hope, 12-step program, last June I had a big surrender with sugar and white flour, and started attending Overeaters Anonymous, and now I have 8 months abstinence in that program.
So. And I've heard it say that if you're not working at least three programs, you're in denial. And there was another hand over here.
I just was curious where the 4 steps are interested to describe.
The question was where the 4 steps of intimacy came from. I'll let you answer. Well, I'll just say,
Oh, yeah.
Steve made him up. Yeah, he's very, very creative based on, we had some friends who shared with us this inventory process they did, and he got the idea from that and wrote this out. And we do it in kind of an informal way. We can do it pretty automatically now.
Is it available?
Yes.
Yes.
Talk to us after.
Talk to us at the meeting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Right here.
I just want to ask, is there an APA meeting in Silverbeach on the beach?
As far as I know, yeah, 9 a.m. Near the jetty.
There used to be.
Saturday. It was Saturday.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
I want to know when after the meeting.
Okay.
In the back.
What was the marriage program that you guys, the retreat, who was that sponsored
for? Okay, through one of my meetings, when a friend of mine found out that I'd begun dating Angie, he invited us to this couples retreat, a Valentine's couples retreat. It was AA and Al-Anon couples in recovery, and we used to meet in San Juan Capistrano. And the first year we went, we were dating in 2002, and the second year we went, we were engaged, and the third year we went, we were married, and the sixth year we went, we led the damn thing.
And I'm sure...
And if you talk to us after the meeting, we can get you information on that also.
We also go to, there's one in Arrowhead. There are various couples retreats with 12-step programs.
Mm-hmm. How would you find them?
Talk to us, we'll give you information. Well, yeah, we'll give you information. It's pretty easy. Yeah. But they might even still have vacancies for the Arrowhead retreat in June. Yeah. Very powerful. Mm-hmm. Anything else?
Yes.
Hi. I loved your guys' story. I was kind of dating like the best friend 2 years ago, so they may have come to Alabama. And gone through this law, kind of as been learned. But there was a lot of times when we were mirroring each other when we had issues. How would you deal with stuff, say, like, you know, that you work through your inventory introspectively, but say, like, you see in him, oh my gosh, he has this issue, but I can't really tell him it because it's not my job to tell his inventory. That's like, oh my God, you're driving me crazy.
Okay, the question is...
Could everyone hear, or do we need to repeat it?
No, I think we need to repeat it, right?
Yeah. Okay.
Especially if they're taping you. The question is, what do we do when we have issues that are being mirrored in the other person? And I'll take a stab at that, and you can too. We work our own program, and we use I statements, and we talk about how we feel around whatever is coming up for us. And you know, we're very good at fighting. Yeah, no, we're very no, we're not. We you know, we're very good at expressing our feelings and being clean. I think being clean with it by doing a 10th step before we talk sometimes, and in working our own program. You can.
You did a good job.
Yeah, oh, thank you.
Right here.
How much do you share with each other, and how much do you save for Peter's responsibility? So as far as intimacy, do you tell each other everything, or do you save things for your girlfriend and sponsor and
I have some passion around that that I'll answer, and then I think Angie would like to add something. That kind of speaks to the, you know, building container relationship. And for me, it was a really tough question of, like, you know, I want to be authentic, I want to be honest and forthcoming, but I also know I've got a lot of my own stuff and stuff that is triggered from stuff way before, you know, it's nothing to do with Angie. And what can I do first offline, either with myself and my relationship with my higher power, my own inventory work, and then what I can't do there, take to my sponsor or my men's group, and then usually, you know, 90% of it, that's totally cleaned up, or that sometimes it turns out that, you know, no, really, this, we do need to talk about this, especially if it's a recurring thing.
Mm-hmm. That's a wonderful question, and I will tell you, for me, there is a fine line between when you need to say something and when you need to keep quiet. And what I learned is that if you choose to keep quiet, you usually get a second chance at saying something. Not so the other way around. Also, there's times when I would need to tell my girlfriends, especially in the very beginning, like, here's what's happening, and she'd say, oh, that's normal relationship stuff. That was really helpful to me. There was one other thing about that.
Darn, I hate it when that happens. Okay? Okay.
Yes.
How do you guys keep the trust, or how do you regain trust if you lost it in each other?
I just want to finish up that last one. Well, we were talking about, I know, I lost it again. Okay, isn't that terrible? I'm going to let you take that one, because I don't think we know very much about, I don't know very much about losing trust, because I don't think I've...
Well, because I've been in a relationship for 11 and a half years, and we were going to get married when we were fusing. I've been in the program for 2 years, he's been in the program for one. How long is it going to take them to catch up to me? So, you know, where we're at the same page, we can trust each other again. It's like, how do you regain trust?
Well, I'm hearing that maybe it's not regain, it's established, that it's, it maybe has not even, hasn't really been established yet, and it could take some time. One of the things that Angie said that was so endearing, and I was like, here is a wise woman. One time she could tell that I was, you know, kind of a little tentative, had a little bit of ambivalence about making the first move, and she says, you know, I want no man before his time. So I think the big thing for me has been to be able to trust the process, you know, and trust higher power to guide when the next thing's supposed to happen. You know, be as conscious and awake as possible for indications on which way to go, and counsel with others, yeah.
I do want to go back to that other question. I do not want to hear, I learned this the hard way, the things that should have been filtered. I do not want to press him to talk about something until he's ready. This happened one time when he was in the depression that he referred to, and words can be very harmful if they come out in an unfiltered way. So I try to be very careful that I do get some filter before I talk about things or I calm down. And like I said, I do not want to hear. If he tells me I don't want to talk about that now, I better back off or I will really be sorry.
It only happened once, really. I'm almost over it. It's been 9 years.
Laughing is so healthy. I've been in recovery for over 10 years, and thankfully I have a spouse who has been extremely supportive. And yet, coming this weekend, I discovered there's many things that he needs to see, because he even sent me a text, you know, I'm so glad that you're continuing to grow. And I am. And yet there's so many things that he could learn from being in these rooms. How do you... How do you approach something like that when you see the benefit and you're in, you know, in the trenches and you're doing everything to make yourself the best person you can be, and yet, and you're getting the support and the rah, 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 and yet, what do you do?
You know, I don't mean to be glib about this, but the way I hear this question is, what do we do when we wish we could share our program with others and they're not acting like they want it yet? And there are so many people who could have such great lives if they would just do things the way I thought.
Yeah. Amen to that.
Especially the darn loved ones. I don't have a good answer for that, but being a program of attraction and practicing acceptance. There's so many people who could especially use Al-Anon, don't you think? Shouldn't we take them all there? I find myself thinking people really need it.
I think it's very cruel, you know, that
men and women get married, and when a man gets married, he's hoping the woman doesn't change, and she does, and the woman's hoping the man will change, and he doesn't.
So you mentioned that you guys live in a couples community, and did you choose that location and give up careers? Or did you have to negotiate, kind of a big...
I would like to clarify, we don't live in a couples community. We're part of a couples community, where we go to couples retreats, and you know what? One person described the couples retreats, he said it's like a family reunion where you see people each year, but it's one you want to go to. We love people that we see once or twice a year. We feel really intimate with them. And then we have couples meetings that meet pretty much monthly. Yeah.
Way in the back.
Hi, I'm Sam. Thank you all so much. I got so much out of what you all said. I just started dating maturely for the first time in my life a month ago, and it's been quite interesting. I'm not dating exclusively in the program or programs. I'm dating, I leave it open. And it's been amazing with recovery and knowing what unconditional love is today, and being able to give it, receive it, let it go, and all that. Actually, I dated a guy that wanted to take me hostage in Santa Fe 3 weeks ago, and after the second date, he had the china picked out. And I was like, and he told me part of his story, and I was like, no. And I'm like, we're going to be sisters. You really need to go to Al-Anon. And so I told him when the next Al-Anon meeting was. And he didn't show up until the last 10 minutes. And he came in and he broke down and let, some of his childhood out. And, it was very emotional and very touching. And it doesn't mean that, that's fragile. First coming in, but I was able to really detach after that and say, he's in God's hands. Mm-hmm. It was a miracle when he showed up, and I'm grateful that I got to say that to him. But
we never know when we can touch someone else's life.
That's right.
Yeah. Is there a question, Sam?
Yeah. We all come into each other's lives for a reason, and we don't know what that reason is. Mm-hmm. But yes, do you recommend that we date just in 12-step program, or what is your recommendation?
Well, it's really important, I think I can speak for both of us, that we not hold ourselves out to be some kind of experts. We really are just here to share our own experience, strength, and hope, and I wouldn't propose to have an answer for anybody else in the room. It's important to have the right questions. And I'm a big believer in sponsorship, being a part of a community, a men's group, and doing prayer and meditation for guidance, mm-hmm. and being patient for the answers. And I think one of the tendencies I notice in myself is I have this tendency to want immediate gratification and immediate answers, and I don't want to live with unresolved questions or unresolved problems. And it's, I think, a big growth area has been is being able to trust the process, be okay with where I am now, and let things unfold, and before I make big decisions, seek counsel.
And I would add to that, when we were in that I don't think anybody can say what's right for every person, every situation. When our first couples group that we were in, there was a guru couple who used to say, you pool all your money and that's what you do. And I don't believe that it's the same answer for everybody. We have a third step, we have an 11th step, and that's it. We ask God, we go to our higher power for guidance.
Mm-hmm. There was another hand.
Dal.
Yes. What's your take on this whole soulmate hypothesis? Even eHarmony is talking about through the computer you can find your soulmate who's perfectly compatible, as if there's only one. What's your take on that, to who you were called to marry? Choices versus...
You want me to take it?
The question is, what's your take on a soulmate?
Her answer will be funnier.
As to who you are called to marry? Philosophically, I do not believe that there is only one person that a person could be happy with. Statistically, the likelihood is that's not true. But I don't know if the statistical likelihood is if I would have ever met the other one. I don't really know any of that. But I think that there has to have been more than one, but it didn't feel that way. It feels like I'm with exactly the person that I was supposed to be with at this point. So,
Seems to become more and more evident and substantiated as each year passes.
But it's like, maybe, and would this person be your soulmate if they weren't going to work on it with you? Yeah. When I set my vision for what I wanted in a relationship, by that time, I had a very short list. But it was really important things. One of them is, and you know, I used to joke like they have to be, you know, breathing, not falling down drunk, and not gay and want me, but... But it kind of got a little more than that, and more seriously, and one of the things is that they do have to want me. I mean, I didn't want anybody who wasn't ready. I don't want anybody who doesn't know what they want. I'm done with that. I'll be alone. I'm not going to go through that anymore if they don't know what they want. And that they had to have, they didn't have to be in program, but they had to have their own spiritual program of some kind. And I have met people who seem to have natural built-in programs, not very many. They're not quite as much fun, but I have met people like that. They had to have financial independence, not a lot of money, but I could sum it all up, spiritual, prosperous, and fun. And prosperity has to do with, it's not about money, it's about a consciousness, it's about spirituality, it's about so many things. But one of the big things, I think there was only 10 things on my list, is that they need to be willing to work on the relationship. And they have to want to be with me. If they don't want to be with me, forget it.
So I think we have time for a couple more, just two more questions. Okay.
Yeah, mine is a two-part one. I really like the 4 R's of the relationship. And then he said something about 5 somethings that had included accountability and a weekly check-in, and I don't think I got those 5. So that was one question. The other one is, have you got any good stories or input on in-laws?
You know, I'm going to address the second question, is any input around in-laws. You know, one of my must-haves was I did not want my potential partner to have a lot of drama in family to bring to the table, because my first marriage, that was the case. I just didn't want to sign on for that again, and so it just worked out that way. I mean, I just felt so crazy in love with her, I might have been willing to put up with more than I needed to. In fact, I'm really sad now that I didn't get to meet my mother-in-law. She, Angie's mom passed like right when we started dating. So, but as far as, the 4 gateways to intimacy, we can talk to you about after the meeting where you can find that.
There was one more back there. Yes.
I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about the closest you've ever been to breaking up and how you stay together.
Oh, I will take that. Is it okay if I talk about
this? Cool, girl.
I told you I was in heaven. I was deliriously happy. I mean, I was 54 when we got together. I was 56 when we got married. I could not believe I finally found somebody. Everything was completely wonderful. We got married, and a couple years later, he went into a big depression. And my bubble was absolutely burst. And he came home one day and said he didn't know if he could be married. My initial reaction to that was to get rid of him fast, because it was clear I was going to get seriously hurt. Just kick him out. I was fine before. And then that started settling in. And then one day he came home and he said that a man from his men's group committed suicide because he was a teacher and he couldn't grade the papers. And I finally got it, that it wasn't about me, that it was very serious. That depression means that you're not sure you could show up for dinner.
And we were very honest, more honest than I ever thought I would be with anyone. And we let it be okay to be where we were, and we were honest, and step by step, and gradually, and slowly, and over a period of time, it was better than ever, because I showed him every ugly thing. I made all the ugly faces, and I just flipped out one day. And I told him I hated him 4 or 5 times, and I'd never said a cross word to him. And he was kind of enjoying it. And I walked into his room and I said, well, I feel a lot better. I still hate you, but I feel better. And after that, and over a period of time, it was better than it had ever been, because I didn't have any fear of showing my real self, and I felt that we were more intimate.
Yeah, I was experiencing some burnout in my workplace because it was just so intense. You know, I ended up going to work in the field of addiction medicine, and doing that full time after, it was, I don't know, at that point, like 15 years, and I was just really getting burnt out. And like I said before, the adjustment of living together, and I went into this depression, and the first thing I said was, you know, I'm evaluating everything. You know, I don't know if I can continue in my job. And as you said, evaluating everything, does that mean your marriage? And honestly, yeah, everything. I mean, I felt like I was fighting for my life. And the beautiful gift that you gave me was to simply be able to hold the space for me to have where I was at, you know. And I love this. I want to close with this. This was where the name of the men's group that I've been involved with for 20 years came from, White Sky Men's Council, and it's by a turn of the century poet by the name of Rainier Maria Rilke. And it's a work from his work entitled On Love and Other Difficulties. I hold this to be the highest task of a bond between two people, that each should stand guard over the solitude of the other. For if it stands in the nature of the crowd to recognize no solitude, then love and friendship are continually there to provide the opportunity for solitude. And only these are the true sharings which rhythmically interrupt periods of deep isolation. A togetherness between two people is an impossibility, and yet where it seems to exist, it is but a reciprocal, a narrowing, against which can rob either party of their fullest freedom and development. But once the realization is accepted that even between the closest human beings, infinite distance continues to exist, a wonderful living side by side can grow up, if they succeed in loving the distance between them, which makes it possible for each to see the other whole and against the wide sky. Thank you so much.
Perfect. Thank you.